This is Audible.
High School Dropout to Harvard. My Life with Dyslexia. Written by John D. Rodriguez. Narrated by Morgan Ingram. Chapter 1. Freak Shoes. With my undiagnosed dyslexia, my growing self-doubt, and the lack of sympathy from my family, it is no wonder God thought it best that I have warped feet. My feet curved inward, bad enough that others noticed it when I walked. But it was worst whenever I ran in a game of freeze tag or soccer. My feet would often hit the back of my leg when they were coming around to make the next step. I was an awkward sight to see. My parents took me to the doctor, who prescribed me a pair of orthopedic shoes. After prolonged use, these were supposed to straighten the curve in my feet. They were as stylish as orthopedic shoes can be. Surely these shoes would help me blend in with my classmates. The boots were made of rough brown leather, had thick soles, laced up over my ankles, and were lined with metal. They were heavy, and they hurt to wear. I looked at the soft, rubber-soled tennis shoes of normal kids with longing. Naturally, my classmates were discreet and open-minded about my monster shoes.
"Hey, Frankenstein! Go away, freak shoes!"
As if things weren't bad for me already. I couldn't keep up with other kids in class because of my dyslexia. I was forced to sit still in silence for most of the day, which I hated. I slurred my words when I got nervous, and now, to top it all off, I had to wear these huge freak shoes. Thank you, world. I remember standing apart from other kids on the playground. One day, two little girls came around from behind me as we were walking toward the playground for recess. One said, "What's wrong with your feet?" And the other added, "You walk funny." I was crushed. Those mean second graders. What could I say? And what is it about children pointing out the obvious that makes the words hurt so much? I knew I walked funny. That's why I was wearing these shoes. But I said nothing. I couldn't explain to those two girls that my mother's womb had been crowded and that my feet were pressed against her stomach while I was growing inside her, causing my deformity. I started getting in trouble for things I could not help. In third grade, I had Mrs. Garhard as my teacher.
"Pretend your bottom is glued to that chair," she said.
What a terrible image. She looked down at me as she hovered over my desk.
"Good children, sit still," she announced in her shrill voice.
She had a punishment for everything. If I wasn't writing lines for talking in class, I was walking the track during lunch for not sitting still. Report cards came out, and in the additional comments section, she wrote in neat cursive, "Restless, talks too much, needs to improve classroom behavior." So many categories had check marks under the unsatisfactory column. When my parents read the report card, I was punished at home for the behavior that had been punished at school. My life wasn't looking any better until that day. Little did I know that morning, as I strapped on my shoes, pulled on my jacket, ready to face another day as a bottom dweller, that my life was about to change. It was the day our third grade class was taken out to one of the school's baseball fields to learn a game called kickball. The game is played a lot like baseball, but instead of a baseball and bat, you use a rubbery red ball. The game is fairly straightforward. The ball is rolled to you, and you kick it as far as you can, then run to the bases and hope that nobody catches the ball or tags you out. Our PE teacher instructed us on the basics of the game as we all sat on the grass on a perfectly bright spring day. I loved PE class because it meant that I did not have to sit still. Here, I could run around as much as I wanted. Our class was divided into two teams. Halfway through the first inning, kickball quickly became a game our whole class loved. Everyone was yelling and cheering when someone on their team kicked the ball and ran for first base. My team started the game in the outfield, and it wasn't until a couple innings later that I got a chance to kick that red ball. I must have been quite a sight as I stood over home base, a scrawny kid in bulky shoes. I was hoping to get a good kick between the fielders and to make it in time to reach first base. I knew this would be difficult because my shoes made me clumsy, or perhaps they just enhanced my natural clumsiness. I would have to run as fast as I could. The pitcher rolled the ball in a straight line towards me. I ran over to it and kicked it with all of my might.
The rest is a blur. As I kicked the ball, it soared high into the air and kept going higher and higher past the infielders. By the time it got to the outfielders, the ball was so high in the air that all they could do was watch as the ball sailed over their heads. The ball went so far that it landed on another playground on the other side of the field and rolled into a sandbox. It was an amazing kick that left our whole team jumping up and down and cheering as I ran around the bases, and all of our base runners came home to more cheers and high fives. Even some of the other team's members were jumping up and cheering for my long kick. By the time the outfielders had retrieved the red ball, it had taken so long that some of the fielders were sitting down on the grass waiting. Apparently, winning a game is all that's needed to make you an instant hero. From that day forward, whenever we played kickball, kids would always pick me first. If my life were a movie, then at the end of the day I would discover that there had, in fact, been no medal in my shoes that day, and that it had been me all along. Enter triumphant music. Fade to black. Alas, my life was not a movie, but it didn't matter to me. Blame it on performance-enhancing orthopedics, but this one moment changed the course of elementary school life. I don't think anyone knew that inside my prescription boots there lay a series of metal bars which granted me the ability to outkick every boy in my class. After that momentous day, kids stopped teasing me about how I walked, and instead began to regard me as one of the class athletes. Talk about social climbing. I would continue to wear the special shoes for 2 more years. Each year the shoes got smaller and less noticeable. Soon the day came when I would wear them no more. Without the weight of my shoes, my feet felt light on the ground. I remember my overwhelming joy at being able to run, unimpeded at last. I was free. This newfound love would earn me a peculiar distinction in 6th grade. Our school held a charity running event called a jogathon, in which students had family and friends sponsor us, committing a donation for each lap we would finish. Since I no longer wore my special shoes, I was a fast runner. I had so much fun running that I ran more laps than anyone else in the entire school. So much that I was honored by the principal with a plaque, and I received a special award in the form of a donated chin strap from the Los Angeles Rams football star Jim Youngblood. Looking back on this, it was a strange award to receive, but at the time it felt like the best day of my young life. While it may look silly to recount these isolated events of my childhood, I believe these moments changed the way I think about weakness. In line with the idea of three-dimensional thinking, it is a useful exercise to think about whether your particular weakness has a dimension that you have not discovered. In my youth, I considered my freak shoes a weakness, but they had another side to them that could be converted into strength. Likewise, dyslexia is considered a weakness or impediment. Indeed, people with dyslexia are protected under disability laws, in part because learning disabilities impede major life activities, like reading. But I think of dyslexia as a consequence of three-dimensional thinking, which itself can be a strength if properly harnessed. This is why I tell people with learning disabilities, or anyone, to focus on their strengths. People tend to focus on our weaknesses. Some weaknesses will always be weaknesses. No one is going to cure your dyslexia. But you can change the way you approach it, and I believe this is the formula followed by successful thinkers, innovators, and entrepreneurs who also happen to be dyslexic. There was a time in my life where I wished I wasn't different. Then I learned that being different means you stand out as an original. The people we most admire don't blend in. It is only in standing out that people shine the most. Sometimes this can be cringe-inducing, as with my awkward childhood, and you want to blend into the crowd because it's safe. But I've learned that if you want great success, you have to accept the risk of standing apart from the rest. I've had my share of pain and failure, but also my share of success. As a dyslexic student, you struggle every day, which makes you tough. You become resilient. I think this is why so many dyslexic thinkers have an entrepreneurial spirit. They have to make their own way in life and create their own opportunities. There is no doubt that for most people, dyslexia is painful. I have lived it myself, and I see it in others. But I think having some pain in life is good. It makes you more human, and it changes how you interact with others, which can also be a strength. There is no great art or endeavor that does not somehow come from pain.
Even great love exists in relation to the pain of lost love. There is beauty to this fragile balance, and being able to accept both pain and strength has made my life richer. Chapter 2. A Bag of Live Blue Crabs.
Dad, look at the caterpillar.
I know instantly that I've made a mistake. I brace myself. My father's eyes dart up at me.
What the hell are you saying? Don't you even know how to talk? Why are you so stupid? Say it again, he boomed.
I'm frozen, but break the silence because I know I need to.
Cap-pa-pa-pillar?
I say with a shaking voice. I'm frightened by my dad yelling at me, confused because I wasn't trying to say it wrong, and angry with myself for being stupid, which my father has said to me many, many times. This scenario repeats itself nearly every time I stumble over language as a child. Sometimes my mother is present when my father says these things, but she never says anything. He saves the worst things for when no one else is around. I am 8 years old at the time. My intuition was correct, though. I could not help saying the word incorrectly. My learning disability affects how my brain processes information. So even though I knew the word caterpillar, and knew I said it wrong as soon as I said it, I could not help the way the word came out. For most people, spoken language comes out simultaneously with one's thoughts. But I can't do that. I think faster than I can process spoken language. I'm usually thinking of another word or thing before I finish the last word, so the words come out garbled. The word caterpillar is an excellent example of this phenomenon. A dyslexic child knows the word and may even have many visual associations about the insect, but in the midst of thinking about all this, jumps over one of the syllables. So the strong P sound comes sooner in caterpillar, which turns into capapillar. A complex answer behind a seemingly stupid mistake. And because of the nature of a learning disability, one that cannot be fixed, no matter how many times you call a child names. I know something is wrong, but at this point I've never heard the word dyslexia, much less know I have a learning disability. During this part of my life, I feel as though my father almost delights in making fun of me. I'm always messing up, he's always yelling, and this just makes it worse. I get more and more anxious about speaking around my parents. I'm a kid, maybe 11 years old now, and have lots of energy, so I'm always playing outside. One day I fall off my bike while attempting a jump, and I break my lip open. I come home dirty and bleeding. My dad sees me, rushes me into the bathroom, and splashes me with water. He looks at me, curls his fingers into a fist, and punches me in the face. I'm stunned, and I say nothing about it to no one. I wished so much that someone would come and save me, but no one ever came. I don't know why he did it. Maybe because I'm a constant disappointment, or maybe because I remind him of himself. He stutters and has all his life. His parents were bad people. One summer, my parents decide we are old enough to travel by ourselves, so they put us on a plane to Louisiana to spend the summer with our grandparents. Louisiana is a mishmash of land and swamp and a dream for any boy who wants to explore. A long time ago, our relatives came down the Mississippi and had nowhere else to go. Others had arrived by boat when it was still a French colony. My mother loved saying, "When it comes to Louisiana, you are either French or you are not." Our family was a combination of French, Black, and American Indian. We are closely related to hundreds of people. The Derensbourgs, De Queers, Mouton, and Honorés. Some nights I've had dinner 2-3 times because when you visit a relative you have to eat dinner at their house so as not to offend. The Louisiana air fills my nose through the rolled down window of my grandfather's Oldsmobile. It smells like green moss growing close to water and lazy wildflowers trying to stay out of the hot sun. The air is so heavy and humid you can taste it. Summertime in Louisiana means you sweat pretty much nonstop. You sweat as soon as you step out of the bath. It's hot. We travel from my grandparents' home in Baton Rouge to New Orleans to visit some relatives. I'm walking down a street in the French Quarter, hurried along by my grandfather,
but catch a glimpse through the door of a burlesque house where I see a woman on a swing who's missing all her clothes. As trumpets and trombones play, voices whoop, and the night is sweet with tobacco and perfume. "Keep walking," my grandfather says as my brother and I pause momentarily. I love New Orleans. My grandfather ate eggs and grits every morning with French bread. When all your meals are made from scratch, you live a certain kind of life. Slow, but good. He could walk through town and talk to anyone and everyone about something. He might not know you, but could still tell a joke or make an observation that would make you laugh. His charm had been refined over many decades, and I thought he resembled an old gray fox, worn by time but cunning as ever. He was good with his hands, too. In his youth, he worked in his father's blacksmith shop, and all that lifting made him really strong. Not one to waste all that muscle, he became an amateur boxer, and that's how Jimmy Cook became known as Whoop-Ass Jimmy. Inspired by his story, my brother and I decide we want to be boxers, too, so we start boxing in the back room. "You boys settle down," he says. We start chanting, "Whoop-ass Jimmy, whoop-ass Jimmy," and parade with him through the house, the kitchen, and into the backyard. My grandfather's dog, Pepper, comes running over to meet us. She starts barking, and together we are a commotion. My grandfather starts boasting, bobbing, weaving, and throwing punches into the air. My brother and I circle him, Pepper barking. I grab one of his legs, and my brother jumps on his back. "Now you've done it. You are going to get it now," he calls out. And with that, we all hit the ground with a loud thud. We start wrestling in the mud until Grandma came to the screen door. "What you boys doing with your grandpa?" she yells. "You boys get out of the mud and get into this house at once." "But Grandma, we're wrestling with Whoop-Ass Jimmy." My grandmother gives us all a look, and even Pepper is quiet now. My grandfather surrenders. "You boys come over here and help your grandpa up." And that's the story of us fighting the best boxer that ever lived in Baton Rouge. Even though his fighting days were behind him, his hands were still skilled. One day he calls us to the back of the house and starts to teach us how to carve, because boys should know how to carve. We start by pressing pocket knives into bars of soap, and bits of soap flake off as I make geometric designs. Once I had gone through a few of my grandmother's soaps, I begin on small pieces of wood. My grandfather sits beside me and shows me how to strip the bark away so that I'm left with a block of creamy wood. "Hold your knife like this and push the knife away from yourself. That's it." I work until I have the face of a coyote staring up at me from my hands. "Now that's something," he says. Along with carving, our grandfather decides we need to go on a proper fishing trip. We are heading to Old Man Swamp. But along with packing our fishing poles and lures, we clean guns and check ammo. "Grandpa, are we going hunting?" "No, fishing." We pile into an old Chevy with our gear, towing Cousin David's boat behind us. Swamp water is murky brown and green. Cypress trees grow right out of the water, and reeds and grasses jut out here and there. Where the water ends, thick brush starts. The sky above is bright blue, but the swamp manages to look dark and shaded. "You gotta keep your eyes open," says my grandfather. And when we're on the boat, I understand the need for munitions. The swamp is alive. On the water, I see pairs of eyes flickering and following us as the boat makes her way to the fishing spot. These waters are home to alligator. We are the visitors. I kept scanning the trees and water for something to jump out at us. I see a couple cooling their long bodies on the thick mud that covers the bank. You certainly wouldn't want an alligator to climb into your boat, but my grandfather says they tend to stay away unless provoked. Tend? My eyes are wide open, and I see a bullfrog in the grass, birds rustling in the trees, dragonflies flittering, and a water moccasin snake skimming the water in an S-shaped motion. This is not a place to doze off with a line tied to your toe. Here you have to be on. The fish we catch today have teeth. We spend all afternoon on the swamp, and after so many hours of using all my senses just so I don't get eaten by something, I'm exhausted. On the car ride home, I remember a story my mom told me about my grandfather. He became terrified of water when he almost drowned in the Mississippi as a boy. But as my grandfather would say,
being scared of something isn't a good enough reason not to do it. Another day, we travel to the roadside fish market, which is unlike any supermarket from back home. A bunch of tables are lined up and piled with tanks and buckets and containers of all sizes with catfish, shrimp, crab, oysters, crawfish, and other fish I had never seen. People are talking loudly, bartering, haggling, and old men stand behind the tables. "Is that James Cook? Are these your grandsons?" Everyone seems to speak with that excited incredulity in Louisiana. Even though it's a fish market, it doesn't smell like fish. It smells like crisp water. All the fish here are alive, and that's the only way to buy fish. I stand next to a tank bigger than me that is filled with catfish swimming all about. "Let's pick a good one," he says. "See, you have to look at the gills, the fins, and the skin." No one wants a catfish whose parts look worn. The man grabs a stick with a net on the end and scoops up the fish, pierces the head with a large hook, and skins it, then fillets it on a table and wraps it in paper. Next, we walk toward the blue crab. This place is known for the blue crab, so you don't pick it yourself. Doing so would insinuate that not all their blue crab is fine blue crab, and that would be an affront. So you just say how much you want, and they pack them into a double paper bag. The shells are blue-gray, but the legs are bright blue and flail about as they are tossed into the bag. Sometimes they come out of the tank by the bunch, because they hold on to each other. So we leave with our catfish fillets and writhing bag of blue crab, which my grandfather places in the back seat of the Oldsmobile. My brother and I ride in the front, and I glance back to find that one crab has climbed out of the bag and is now riding on the leather seat. When word gets out that my grandmother is cooking gumbo, relatives from all over decide to pay a visit. This dish she reserves for special days. She stands in the kitchen for hours with her hand slicing okra and celery stalks, dicing onions, pouring out ground fillet grown on our family's land, breaking down a chicken into pieces, unwrapping ham hocks and the hot sausage, deveining mounds of shrimp, and picking the blue crab out of the pool of water we had made for them in the sink. Grandma Ruby moves effortlessly through her kitchen in a light blue cotton dress and floral apron, with her gray hair tied up and her still young blue eyes peering out through small eyeglasses, mmm-hmming to herself. The simmering pot sends up wafts of the sweet smell of the ocean from the blue crab, the bite of shrimp, the spiciness of the sausage, and the hearty warmth of the ham, chicken, and root vegetables come together like disparate notes into a savory harmony. All summer long, I enjoy a sensory feast. For the first time in my life, I am not struggling in school because I am not in school. Neither do I struggle at home because I am away from my parents. So, for the first time, I feel like myself. I feel like someone switched the on button in my life. I want to engage everything and everyone. I now know how to carve wood, mount an expedition, fight a man, pick a prize catfish, make a girl laugh, shoot a gun, dance, saw my first naked woman, and tasted the best food ever. But summer was drawing to a close now, and our departure grew near. "You take care of my grandsons," he said to the flight attendants in New Orleans as we prepared to board our flight home. He gave my brother and I a mighty hug, and we said goodbye. I have never wanted to not leave so much. He knew that he had given two boys one hell of a summer, but he did not know how much that summer had transformed my life. My grandfather died in 1998 at age 86. Chapter 3. Super Floss. Once home, the closest I could get to Louisiana was a large tin of frozen oysters and catfish my grandfather mailed each Christmas. I tried to hold on to summer for as long as I could, like a dream that you don't want to forget once you wake up. The bayou fades into the back of my mind. I enter high school, and like my friends, I start wondering about my future. "You're just not very smart. Don't set your hopes too high," my father says to me. My mother moves silently in the kitchen, and after he leaves, she tries to comfort me. "Don't you worry about that." Words can wear you down, and I am so close to giving in, but hope is hard to kill, and I still have a little left. I'm a young man now. The game changes simply because I grow older. By age 15, I'm earning money, and the best thing it buys is freedom. I have a license. I have a motorcycle. For the first time, I can physically leave the house whenever I want. Sometimes I drive around just because. I'm 16, and I hate high school. I live in a constant state of unease because the threat of ridicule looms over me. I stay up until midnight on many nights trying to understand my books and put thoughts onto paper. "You need to try harder," says a teacher with eager eyes. Yes, I say, I will. Because it's too embarrassing to tell her I am already working at capacity. School feels like an obstacle course. It becomes a full-time job for me to hide my disability. That's the thing about dyslexia. It is not something people can see in me. It has to be revealed. I am determined to hide it. The worst part of any class is when the teacher wants to get interactive by having students read out loud. As soon as I see her scanning the class, searching for a name, I dart my eyes down. I act natural because you don't want to freeze completely. That is a sure way to have a teacher focus in on you, I've learned. Every part of me is struggling to blend into the background. John, damn. Please read the next section. Whenever the time comes for reading in class, I make up any excuse. May I go to the bathroom? I'm not feeling well. My throat hurts. Can I pass this time? But even these methods only work so many times. If I cannot avoid reading aloud, I try to pick the shortest passage and read through it a few times before the teacher calls on me. But sometimes there is no escape. I start reading and think, okay, I know these words. I'm good. Oh, wait, what's that word coming up? Oh, no. And here it comes. Crash. I crash into the word superfluous. When I arrive at the word, I pause. My voice, which filled the room a second ago, has suddenly stopped, and the awkwardness is palpable. My well-meaning teacher gives me the most terrible advice. Sound it out, John. I can't sound it out because my brain doesn't work that way. I end up saying something that sounds like super floss. The teacher corrects me, but this has not taught me the word. I read onward. I might trip over another word or two. Then the torture ends. The next kid takes over. I know that when a person writes, something peculiar happens in the mind. I know this because of the way that I write. My thinking and my written expression are disconnected. What feels like a clear idea in my head does not always exit my pen in the same way. My high school essays look like puzzle pieces that I jammed together. I am unable to hide my poor writing from my teachers, so sometimes I just don't turn in my assignments at all. Another bad grade. Maybe my teachers think I don't care about school, but that is not true at all. I would rather have bad grades than feel ashamed about my inabilities. On any given day, I wake up with a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. Another day of getting beat up in the classroom, where my bullies are words, grammar, and syntax. I get so frustrated with school that by the fall of my junior year, I start cutting classes. Before this, I never cut class, no matter how demoralizing. This is the funny thing. I felt like a good kid, a smart kid. But at school, I was a bad student, and I was quickly moving toward the worst label of bad kid with my newfound attitude. And for some reason, it's much easier to give up on a kid we call bad. My relationship with school thus far has always been a struggle, but something changes this year. My frustration reaches a tipping point. I finally realize that school will never change for me. I will never be smart, according to my teachers or parents. I want to cut my losses. I know it's hard for most people, especially parents, to understand my dissatisfaction. After all, high school isn't that bad. Why not just slog through it? You know how they say it is insane to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results? Teachers tell me to work harder. Still not good enough? Work harder still. But my results remain the same. If only someone could say, John, you need to work differently. But no one knows there's something different about my brain. No one tells me that you can be a smart person but a bad student. I begin to fail high school English. not because I could not understand the critique of power and politics in George Orwell's Animal Farm, but because it takes me forever to read a book, and just as long to write a decent paper. In fact, I was initially drawn to some of my favorites, Animal Farm, The Pearl, Old Man and the Sea, just because of their slim size. But I can't keep up in the class. There is not enough time between assignments for me to produce good work or learn from my teacher's comments. So, along with my grade, my self-esteem plummets. Because I was so dissatisfied with my school life, I start to disengage. My life splinters into two different directions. School, painful and tedious. Life outside school, freeing and interesting. For a 16-year-old kid, this meant girls. Well, more specifically, trying to get girls to notice me. Naturally, I decide to perm my hair and pierce my ear. Hey, it's the 1980s. I start skipping school more and more. I watch a double feature matinee. I ride my motorcycle to the beach. I walk through downtown in a black leather jacket, even though it's warm and sunny, because that's the sort of thing we did back then. I make a girl laugh on the sidewalk one day, and let her drive my car even though she's never driven a car before. I fall in love with her, so I visit her at high school more than I attend my own high school. "Are you even a student here?" someone asks eventually. I decide I will only attend the classes I enjoy. A biology lecture here, a Spanish class there. I skip the classes that bore me. I do still attend one class faithfully, an after-school culinary class that I decided to take on a whim. My transcript suffers for it because I am enrolled in those classes whether or not I show up. I know that I'm failing some classes, but I would rather fail on my own terms than because of an unfair standard. At this point in my life, I still don't know I have a learning disability, but I am certain that something is off, and it feels like I'm not getting a fair shake because of it. I cannot be sure which direction my life would have taken had I grinded toward graduation. My decision to leave school was finalized a few months after I started the culinary class, which quickly became my best subject. Although I did not yet know where this path would take me, it was enough to know that I was good at something. For once, the work I put in matched the outcome. My teacher praised me. What a feeling. I learned I could start working right away if I wanted. Choosing between this new, wonderful part of my life and my battle waged with school? It wasn't even close. Friends and teachers warned me, tried their hardest to convince me I was making a terrible mistake. High school dropout. No one wants to be one. The label not only signals that you never completed a basic education, it suggests something about your character. You must be the sort of person who quits everything. There's not enough substance in your soul or fire in your belly. You must not have any good role models in your life. Your parents were not good parents. You are destined to make less money in your lifetime compared to your peers. Statistically, you are more likely to become a criminal. You should be ashamed. When I dropped out of school, I didn't feel ashamed. I was incredibly happy. This surprises people who think I must have felt awful. But dropping out of high school was not my failure. My failure was how I performed in high school. I attribute a rich, adventurous life and great personal success to everything that happened through my decision to drop out of high school. In retrospect, it's one of the smartest things I've ever done. Not that I stopped caring about school, but that I stopped caring about what everyone else wanted me to do. So you see, I do not think I've been successful despite dropping out of high school, but because I did. I didn't end up at Harvard despite my decision, but because of it. Now, this is a fine view to have as I reflect back on my life, but my parents had less optimistic opinions about my decision to leave school at the time. My mother said, "I have failed with you, and my father's low expectations about me seem confirmed." I soon learned that in the world outside of school, life worked differently. Here, there are several ways in which a person can succeed. Being resourceful, creative, and unrelenting is constantly rewarded outside of school. I feel free, like that day I was finally able to run for the first time, like those mornings spent exploring the bayou with my grandfather. It would be years before I discovered that I had a disability hardwired into my brain, which had specific effects on how I learned. It was only after this realization that I came to the conclusion that I needed to actively navigate and advocate for myself in the school system if I wanted to reach an academic goal. I would reach those goals many years later, and in the meantime, my work provided me the opportunity to travel all over the world and leave home for good. So, no hard feelings about being a high school dropout. It's true that I did not graduate from high school. I would eventually graduate from one of the finest universities in the world. Chapter 4. Chipping Away. The real question becomes, what do I want to do? Back then, I don't know the answer, but I decide that I'm going to use my interests as a compass. I discover I have an unusual interest. I become an ice sculptor, which is an uncommon profession, but even more of a rarity at the time I started. I come into this line of work randomly and thanks to a mentor who believes in me even though he barely knew me. My after-school culinary class was unlike my other high school classes. I never felt I needed to race to catch up. Creativity was encouraged. For once, I feel comfortable in a class, and hey, I'm even one of the best students. Cooking is a right-there kind of knowledge, which is half skill and half intuition. You can write a beautiful essay on how to cook an egg, but cooking an egg beautifully is another thing. The chief instructor recommends me for a small job opportunity at a local hotel because I've shown so much interest in his class. I accept right away. Back then, I didn't know how much of my future hinges on this one random opportunity. I could have easily ignored the offer, which carried with it very little pay and only a short duration. But this is the beginning of a practice I still live by today. Pursue all avenues related to that thing you love. The Conestoga Hotel had only hired me for the 2-week period around Christmas time. The walls of the kitchen shine white and the tiles brick red, with rows of stainless steel ranges and prep tables. People in white jackets move quickly and precisely. Everyone is busy. On this first morning on the job, I see an unfamiliar sight. Off to one side of the room, before the main kitchen, I see the chef carving a huge block of ice, working on what appeared to be the delicate feathers of a bird. I have never in my life seen an ice sculpture. The ice gleams translucent and brilliant. It's substantial, but barely there. A tiny bit of nervousness charges through me, much like the feeling I get when my hand reaches for an unfamiliar glass of water. A part of me really wishes I could just smash it. Breaking things might be my siren song. But the thought is overwhelmed by how beautiful the sculpture looks. It does look like a solid piece of glass, but whereas light shoots through glass, the ice sculpture seems to hold on to the light. In the kitchen, the light pours in through a window and into the bird, making it glow. I learn that the man working on the sculpture is the executive chef Charles Collins, who runs everything in the kitchen. He is a big guy who looks like what you would expect a chef to look like in a movie. White chef's coat, prominent belly, and bushy gray hair. I stood for several minutes in awe of his work, all while I was supposed to be in the main kitchen getting instructions for my workday. When the chef sees me fixated on what he is doing, he calls me over. I walk over and he barely looks up at me. The other two part-time workers that I started with that morning had already proceeded to the main kitchen. After a few minutes, the kitchen manager comes looking for me because I'm not where I'm supposed to be. He found me in the back with the chef, and he says, "Come on, we need you in the main kitchen." There was a short pause. Chef Collins rumbled, "The kid's working with me." Chef Collins, or Charlie, as he preferred I call him, took me under his wing that day. The man began to teach me the fundamentals of ice sculpting. From that day forward, my mind is filled with ice sculpting. Ice, ice, ice. Every day, I visualize different objects and animals three-dimensionally in my mind. I become obsessed with this way of thinking, which feels exciting and natural. When I approach the ice, I think about the sculpture as something I can hold in my hands and see from all sides, even before I've touched the ice. I know instinctively how hard or softly to press my chisel. I think about that coyote I carved out of wood with my grandfather. Maybe I'm a natural sculptor. It certainly feels natural. Many years later, when I was a university student in a magnificent library, I learned about the master sculptors. I read descriptions of their work that resonated with how I think about all things, not just sculpting. Michelangelo said, "Every block of stone has a statue inside it, and it is the task of the sculptor to discover it." Most beautifully, he also said, "I saw the angel in the marble and carved until I set him free." I think this is the perfect description of how three-dimensional or visual thinking really works. You are presented with a problem. You then eliminate all non-solutions until your mind grasps the solution, and it feels like the mind is literally grasping the answer all of a sudden. You set the solution free. Charlie showed me first how to use the chisel. He told me that striking the ice with a chisel is similar to a small rock hitting the windshield of a car. If the chisel hits the ice straight on, it will create a small crack that will slowly grow bigger and bigger, like a vein running through the entire block. This is why it is important to always strike the ice from an angle. My task was to learn the different angles. A single sculpture might require numerous carving methods, and the nature of the sculpture might require these be done in a particular order. So, not only did you have to be able to visualize your sculpture with detail, but you also had to map out the process in your mind. At times, this was complex work, but it had zero reading or writing involved. I was in love with sculpting. The chef showed me how to outline a figure on the ice with the tip of a chainsaw and how to cut into the ice so the ice slush would spray clear in a stream and not build up on the back of the saw. I loved learning from Charlie because he didn't just tell me how to sculpt. He would show me by actually sculpting in front of me and allowing me to sculpt on the spot. Don't hesitate. And I don't. I learned quickly from Charlie, and before long he had me doing parts of ice sculptures that would be used for parties in the banquet rooms. I remember him showing me how to cut the V grooves on an ice seashell that would later be filled with shrimp as part of a cold seafood buffet. This made me think that sculptures didn't have to be purely decorative. They could be functional. And the meaning of one sculpture might change depending on which other sculptures it offset. I watch the clock tick to 8 p.m., but wait until the chef nods to us, dismissing us for the day. Whenever Charlie works on a sculpture, he lets me keep the large pieces of ice trimmed off the 300-pound blocks he uses. I pick these up from the floor and store them in large tubs that I slide into a walk-in freezer. I pull the heavy tub to my car and anxiously drive home. In my parents' garage, I lay the large slab of ice on the floor and set my tools out on a tarp, a four-prong ice pick, a curved handsaw, and a chainsaw. Something simple would be fast but boring. I feel ambitious. I slice into the block with the chainsaw, and although the motor buzzes angrily, the blade cuts smoothly. It sends a spray of ice flying into the air, which falls like snow. I shape the rough contours of a body, wings, and long neck. The chainsaw slices V-shaped indents that open up to the back to make outstretched wings that look like they're about to take off in flight. Next, I bring out a small-toothed handsaw to round out the head, the bulk of a body with wings, and smooth out the curved neck. I use the ice pick like a pencil to make feathers, the lines of a beak, and the tiny bead of an eye. I take a few steps backwards until I'm standing in the chilly night outside the garage looking in. I angle my car in the driveway so that my headlights can flood the garage. The glowing swan looks out of place in the dusty, cramped garage. The sculpture is covered in a wet sheen. "Come see what I made," I say to my parents. They shuffle out, and a moment of stunned silence turns into a chatter of praise and questions before my mom runs back in the house to grab the camera. After everyone packs back into the house, I sit in front of the ice swan for a long time, just thinking. I imagine a swan skeleton under the surface and decide next time I'll make the cheekbone more pronounced. I slowly drag the heavy swan to the bottom of our driveway and leave it sitting by the curb. I wake up extra early the next morning and find the neighborhood children patting their hands against the wet remnants of wings. By the time I get back from work in the evening, it's as if it was never there. 2 weeks later, I had dropped out of high school for good, and I'm julienning a small mountain of carrots for a banquet. I wear a big smile these days. People at home still have unchanged opinions about my decision to leave school, but I do not care. This is what it feels like to be good at something? It feels like I stepped into the world for the first time and discovered the hidden truth that life is actually pretty good and people are nice. I learn something new each day. I sharpen my sculpting skills with each new sculpture. I learn something different about each one, which I file away in my mental catalog. I continued working at the hotel, but 3 months after dropping out of high school, I start my first business and sold my first sculpture commissioned by the local Elks Lodge. For some reason, they needed a goose riding on a wave. I obliged. I knew that my sculptures were good enough to be used by the hotel in banquets, and I also knew that people paid a lot of money for those banquets, so accepting private commissions felt like a natural extension of my work. People were calling me to hire me to do ice sculptures for them. I did not have to solicit for business because I was getting so much already. About a year into my work, a large metal cutting company called me with a job to do 7 ice sculptures for $2,700. They wanted to highlight their newest product development with a lavish cocktail party and lots of ice sculptures. I quickly accepted this job and went to work creating a number of pieces that included an eagle swooping down on a sunray, a seahorse and an angelfish for a seafood buffet, and the company logo atop an ice mountain that I placed strategically on a base in the middle of a water fountain. This one contract made my ice sculpting business take off, and suddenly I had such an influx of commissions I could barely keep up. Producing good work led to more opportunities and more phone calls, and I actually relied on word of mouth to exclusively drive my business. I was now 17, and in less than a year I went from being a hopeless academic failure to having some financial success. I credit that success and all the places it would take me to my decision to pursue my interests, which led me to develop a skill, which I then honed, and ultimately that skill became valuable. My life before this decision had focused on the things I could not do. Despite investing a great amount of time and effort, my gains were only marginal. That was not a sustainable way to live and had pushed me to the brink of losing myself. When I decided to follow my own path, I essentially inverted that dynamic. Instead of doing lots of work and producing little effect on something I hated, I did a little bit of work each day on something I loved and got massive rewards out of it. For this reason, the best advice I can give to a person with a learning disability is to focus on what you are good at and sharpen that skill. The changes in your life can be dramatic. I prefer to work around weaknesses or develop strategies that help you confront them. But you should never throw the primary thrust of your life behind the things you will never be able to change. I would continue to work at the hotel for 2 years because I genuinely loved working there. I was not paid much. In fact, the money I earned through my own ice sculpting business far exceeded that which I made working at the hotel. But I didn't care. I didn't know it at the time, but the value of my time could not be measured in money alone. The best part about my job was having Charlie as a mentor. He talked to me in the way that a coach talks to his team. He would say to me, "You're a chef. You should hold your head up high when you walk into a room. Stand by that ice sculpture, and when somebody asks you, 'Who made this?' you say in a proud voice, 'I did.' Be proud of what you made and be proud of who you are." Charlie pushed me to compete in ice sculpting competitions. I didn't know that sort of competition even existed, but I was soon working in chilled rooms under time constraints. The hardest part was moving the sculpture with painstaking care. One bad move and a fragile fin, limb, or neck might snap off. At one such competition, my fate would be changed forever. A few days after the competition, I was sitting in an interview.
"So, how did you hear about this job?" the chef asked me.
"Raymond Hoffmeister," I replied.
"Hoffmeister?"
My interviewer seemed taken aback.
"Why the hell? Goddamn like a hell," he said with a thick French accent. "Why didn't you say to me Hoffmeister told you about this job?"
Hoffmeister was the corporate chef for all of the Westin Hotel properties in the Western United States, and he was this guy's boss. I didn't know the power of name-dropping until that day. As soon as I mentioned Hoffmeister, the demeanor of my interviewer completely changed. Suddenly, the chef interviewing me became very interested in me, my work. He proceeded to ask me a few questions only, and then discuss the program and the position in greater detail. I did hear about the job from Raymond Hoffmeister, but he was talking to someone else at the culinary competition about it. So when I said that I heard about the job from Hoffmeister, I was technically being honest. Hoffmeister was a master chef, the highest prestige a chef could ever attain, and one of only a handful of master chefs in the United States at the time. Most people my age who were training to be chefs were in awe of the German chef. Hoffmeister was one of the judges at the culinary competition in which I competed, and Chef Charlie had pointed him out to me and told me to walk around with the crowd that was following him and to listen. So, that is what I did. When most of the people left after he was done critiquing the entries, I hung around and listened some more. And this is when I heard him talking to another chef about apprenticeship openings at the South Coast Plaza, the Century Plaza, and the Bonaventure Hotel. I took in this information, but I didn't think about it until that moment when the chef interviewing me asked me how I heard about the job. Needless to say, I got the job that day. I had seen firsthand the power of networks and how body language, in this case my interviewers, can show your hand in negotiations. Lessons learned. In my new position, I worked under Daniel Simard, a French chef of some acclaim. He gave me creative control over the ice sculptures I made for events. Some of my first creations were an ice rose whose blossom opened up as it melted, and an Easter bunny with frozen Easter eggs, made with the help of water balloons and food coloring. But the hotel put on some of the largest and most lavish parties in Southern California, and for those, the level of my work reached its highest quality. I remember one elaborate party, where banquet planners created a 1,000-gallon lake surrounded by real trees and a bridge across the lake where guests were welcomed into the party. I made 12 ice sculptures, including a massive bear swiping a paw at a salmon, 2 coyotes hiding in the brush, an eagle landing on a ray of light, and 2 geese with wings spread and skimming across the water. For a company event, I made a life-size Ninja Kawasaki motorcycle, which I sat on for a photo prior to presenting. I made ice slippers for a girl's Cinderella-themed bat mitzvah. For a banquet, I assembled a 5-foot replica of the Eiffel Tower from several pieces of ice. For a Christmas party, I made a life-size reindeer. For another event, I made a 1,200-pound, 10-foot dragon. Of course, I made all kinds of sea creatures, lots of angelfish, seahorses, and mermaids. My most memorable mermaid was made for a sail-away party on a cruise ship in Hawaii. The mermaid was nude, and while tasteful in rendition, a manager advised me that the next time I made a mermaid, would I please put seashells on her breasts. Working at the Westin Hotel was much different than my old job. The Westin was much more glamorous. It was located right next to the Segerstrom Center for the Arts, which presented many artists and ballet troupes. I managed to join a small audience watching a dress rehearsal for Placido Domingo, who was staying in the hotel. I also remember the Russian ballet coming to perform, and for the big party we threw to welcome them, Simard asked me to make an ice sculpture of St. Basil's Cathedral. It may have been the most beautiful ice sculpture I ever made. It was used as a complement to a caviar table. I slid 2 bottles of Russian vodka into the ice and carved out a space for tins of beluga caviar. The table was also surrounded with all the caviar garnishes. Russian bellinis kept warm in silver chafing dishes, chopped egg white, yolks, red onions, and capers. The apprenticeship was a process for becoming a chef in which a particular chef accepted you as an apprentice, and you studied under him or her for 3 years. The French chef Simard taught me everything I know about cooking, the classical preparations, delicate and rich tastes, quality ingredients, no shortcuts, cultivate a personal style, demand excellence, and the art of a chef's tantrum in which he erupted in French expletives and kicked things, but never directed at any specific worker. During the apprenticeship, I also took written tests and regular performance tests, in which we had to create a 5-course meal out of a mystery box of ingredients. One might include lamb chops, pork loins, wild mushrooms, truffles, parsnips,
baby carrots, sprigs of herbs, oranges, berries, and a liqueur. It had been almost 4 years since I dropped out of high school, and I was on course to finishing my apprenticeship and becoming a chef. My life had changed so much over the last few years, and I now felt as though I was living in some surreal fantasy world where only good things were always happening to me. I was doing something I loved, making money, and constantly learning. I was in the prime of my youth when I decided to leave everything I knew behind. I came to this decision while I was sitting by a lifeguard tower on Newport Beach. This was a spot I often frequented in the evenings after work. It's so important to have a place to sit and think, a familiar place in which your thoughts can flow unimpeded by the rush of your life. It doesn't have to be far away. These days I do some of my best thinking while I brush my teeth in the quiet of the early morning. But back then, my perfect place for making life decisions was on that beach, where I could see the sunset and the ocean transform from brilliant blue into luminescent black. Staring out into the vastness, I felt inspired to explore what was on the other side of the horizon, that point at which the ships farthest from the shore disappear. I wanted to grasp at the unknown. It was on one such evening, sitting on the soft sand, that I decided to stop thinking about it and actually do it. My opportunity came in the last year of my apprenticeship, where I was poised to become a chef in my own right, able to work at one of various restaurants in which I was interested. We received a letter and photo from a fellow chef who was working in Hawaii. In the photo, he was laying on a raft on clear blue water, wearing sunglasses, sipping a cocktail from a pineapple. Soon after seeing the photo, I knew that's where I wanted to be. I had never been to Hawaii, but I instinctively knew it was something I wanted in my life. I wrote my friend a letter, who gave me an address in Honolulu for the main hiring office for American Hawaii Cruises. In hindsight, I see how easily I could have decided this whole idea was foolish. I think I've found great success in my life because I lack that part of your brain that says, make safe decisions. While this instinct is useful at times, it can also prevent you from doing that which you really want, but you don't want to admit you want. If my opinion on this matter were a ship, then it had long ago cast off the ropes. I was doing this. I put together a letter, resume, and a collection of photographs of my ice sculptures. I put forward my best attempt and waited. About a week later, I got a phone call. "Is this John? We love your work. When can you come to Hawaii for an interview?" I put my hand over the speaker and tried to contain my excitement. At this point, it felt mine to lose. The ball was in my court. I was confident I would get the job unless I really messed up. 10 days later, I was on a plane to Honolulu. They wanted to hire me on the spot, but I finished my apprenticeship, and about 3 months after my interview, I returned to Hawaii to embark on my first voyage at sea. I worked on a contract basis, which meant working between 4 to 6 months at a time. This was followed by time off, ranging from a few weeks to a few months, depending on what I wanted. I was able to quickly grow my savings, which allowed me to travel at my leisure. I thought working on the ship was just as much fun as time off, so I enjoyed returning for another contract, especially if it would take me to new places. And I saw many places. I've counted over 60 countries I visited during a period of 6 years. Chapter 5. Look, a dolphin. I could feel the warm Hawaiian sun on my face as I leaned against the railing and peered into the blue water. The SS Constitution was an old ship from a bygone era, built to expertly sail the ocean, but exuding an effortless elegance while doing so. She was not one of the boxy ships of today, designed to transport a multitude of passengers. Beautiful and grand, with classic wooden railings and plentiful open decks, it was the ship Grace Kelly boarded in New York to sail to Monaco to wed Prince Rainier. The ship was painted white with a blue stripe that touched and ran parallel to the waterline. Her bow was long and sharp, designed to cut through water and maneuver through the high waves of a storm at sea. On days when the sea was calm, time seemed to slow, and you could drink in the sun on the deck and forget you ever had a life before this. In some ways, I think she rehabilitated me.
I let go of my former life, and it drifted away into the open ocean until it was out of sight. I was now sailing with the wind at my back. A glittering blur of lights, dancing, bottomless Mai Tais, a rain of streamers floating and falling on people, shouts and laughter, follow embarkation on Saturday evening. The ship is dying.